to episode 39 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political science professor at UNC Charlotte. And today I'm talking to Stephen Hyland, who is an assistant professor in the Department of History and Political Science at Wingate University. He specializes in modern Argentina and international migration. He has a new book coming out entitled More Argentine Than You, Arab-Speaking Immigrants in Argentina, with the University of New Mexico Press. Stephen, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me.
All right. I always start with this one question. That is, what originally got you interested in studying Latin American history or Latin American political history?
So in general, I grew up in South Texas near the Mexican border. So it was always kind of around me, especially issues of migration, which is my first book that's on or covers. But at the same time, I grew up playing tennis. And so one of my heroes was a guy by the name of John McEnroe. And I just remember watching in the dead of a South Texas summer, Davis Cup ties where McEnroe and his doubles partner Peter Fleming would play against Jose Luis Clerc and Guillermo Vilas in Buenos Aires. And I remember the raucous nature of the crowd and everyone, McEnroe and Fleming and the other tennis players wearing track suits because it was so cold. And it was always something that was just kind of in the back of my mind. So I think the seed to study Latin America has always been there. But what really brought me to the project was in December 99, I went to Buenos Aires for the first time on holiday. And I was taking the train from the suburbs into downtown, and I saw right on the border of Palermo and Belgrano, two really nice neighborhoods in Buenos Aires, what then was in the final stages of completion of what is now the largest mosque in Latin America, the King Fahd Mosque, which was primarily funded by Saudi money. And I began asking myself, what's going on here, and did some research and found out that there was some scholarship, but you know that there was plenty of room for me to make a contribution. So that's kind of like the circuitous path and the moment of serendipity that brought me to study Latin American political history, but in particular with a migration project.
Okay, that's cool. And I mean, yeah, for me too, I think since I grew up on the border, when you grow up in that area of the United States, then oftentimes it just becomes sort of a natural evolution.
I agree. Corpus Christi, where I grew up, was a zone of regional migration. And we have a lot of sorghum fields and cotton fields right around the area. So it was a constant pole of attraction.
So now thinking of that research, you just published an article in the Latin Americanist about Muslim immigrants and Juan Perón. So just talk to me a little bit about the timing and causes of that migration.
So when we think of Muslim migration, I'm interested in the migration of the late 19th and early 20th century. Muslims, as you well know, were part of the transatlantic slave trade, who were forced to places like Brazil, the Carolinas, and places in between. So I look at that moment of, if you will, free or voluntary migration beginning in earnest in the second half of the 19th century that really had a tremendous transformative effect on Argentina, as well as Brazil, the United States, and Canada, and other places such as that. Now, in particular, for the Muslims that I study, they begin showing up rather late. They're part of a flow out of what is now Syria and Lebanon, Israel, and the West Bank and Gaza. So we're talking post-1890. And it really begins to ramp up in the 5 to 6 years before the First World War, so that we believe that there may have been as many as 30,000 Muslims in Argentina by 1917, which when you compare to the 300,000 Italians or the 300,000 Spaniards in the city of Buenos Aires is quite small, but still 30,000 Muslims is a significant number.
Yeah, and so is that economic migration?
It's primarily economic migration. Now, there's some certain moments, historical phenomena in the late Ottoman period that helped drive it. For instance, the Balkans go into wars of secession in 1911, 1912. It's rebellion against Istanbul. And that provided a large chunk of the conscripts for the military. Well, once they lose that, then they begin pulling bodies from Syria.
Gotcha.
And Lebanon. And so this was also a spur that led Muslims to really seek better lives, if you will, in the Americas.
Okay. And the one thing, thinking about Perón himself, obviously, Peronism is populist. It's sort of one of the perfect examples of it. And populism can often be xenophobic. Doesn't have to be. It's obviously Perón opened doors for immigrants in a really welcoming way. And as you note in the article, I think it was in the article, even Evita was involved. So what made Argentina like that, do you think?
It's actually a really good question. And there are, as you can imagine, on the phenomenon of Peronism, there is just a number of studies that are on it. Now, if you will, there, the first iterations and generations of Peronist studies have really tried to focus on what it was and what it is. But more recently, and I'm thinking of people like Valerio Manzano, a guy by the name of Eduardo Elena, and the great Ronan Ryan, an Israeli historian who's been studying Peronism for the last 25 years, the focus has moved from what it was to what it meant. And so we've been trying to figure out what it meant to live in this Peronist moment, what it meant to empower certain segments of society that may have been disempowered in the previous decades of massified politics in Argentina. And what kind of intrigued me is when I was doing my dissertation research about a decade ago, I was having a conversation with this Lebanese Argentine, and his grandfather originally migrated to Argentina, and then his father migrated back to Lebanon.
Huh.
And then when Perón came to power, Perón had a state initiative to bring back children of former immigrants to Argentina.
Wow.
So the Argentine state paid for this guy, this Lebanese Argentine guy, and his family to come back to Argentina. And I'd never heard that before. No one's really ever written on it. I certainly haven't written on it myself.
So what was Perón doing? I mean, what was that? Why?
I think part of it, and I don't have a good answer, but you know, I'll speculate here. I think part of it is this belief in the myth of immigration, its importance to the economy. And it may have also been a factor that he thought that there was an economic necessity for these sorts of workers. Now, certainly the scale of immigrants coming during the Peronist moment was nothing like the period prior to 1914,
right,
or even the period in the 1920s. It was kind of an uptick after the First World War. But there was a concerted government program trying to bring back these kids and former immigrants to Argentina based upon the rhetoric of immigration is a net positive for the nation and its development.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I hadn't really thought of that. It's almost obvious is that that mythology, as you put it, is stronger in Argentina than anywhere, I would think, right? That idea of immigration being an economic driver and being a net positive. In most countries, that's not necessarily the case.
No, you're absolutely right. And so you'll even see it sprinkled throughout the newspapers in different decades saying that, you know, they need to ramp up the immigrants and its relation to economic development.
So my first question as I was reading about this is that, okay, it's one thing to say we want immigrants, but it's another thing to say we want non-Catholic immigrants. So what was the reaction of the Catholic Church in Argentina to these kinds of initiatives under Perón?
So the timing of the article, as you know, like this movement to build the mosque in 1950, Perón is still in the good graces of the Roman Catholic Church. And insofar as what I found research wise, there was no open resistance to this initiative. Not to say that there weren't currents of prejudice towards them. Certainly there were, and there are in Argentina today, but there was nothing overt, nothing that I found, not to say that it's not there, but nothing that I found would suggest that there was a campaign, whisper, or public against this initiative. I mean, Perón viewed the idea that if you subscribe to the national symbols, if you subscribe to the support of the Constitution, either the 1853 version or the one that he put into place, then you were a good Argentine. Ronan Ryan has written rather beautifully about this recently. And this is not to say, you know, I don't want to give kind of like a rose-tinted depiction of populism under Peronism, but the fact of the matter is, it invited a lot of people into a mass political movement unprecedented in Argentine history.
Now, you mentioned the mosque, which is in the article. Why don't you just quickly explain what that was all about?
So in 1950, they're celebrating the centenary of the death of the independence hero, José de San Martín. And so this is a huge moment. So you look at all the newspapers from 1950, and they say it's the year of San Martín. So there's all sorts of huge public outgoings. Now, while this is going on, as you can imagine, Perón wraps himself in the legacy of San Martín.
Sure.
And as he invites the Argentine public to join him, in, not only in his movement, but also the celebration of the life of the liberator, minority groups, labor movements, and general supporters of Perón also adopt this sort of discourse and these practices. And this was a particular moment where it converged with a very energetic Egyptian diplomat who tried to corral all the different variants of and currents of Islam that were represented among the immigrant population in Argentina, to coalesce them, put them into, you know, a movement of common purpose to build this sacred space in one of the great cosmopolitan cities of the world.
It really strikes me how that kind of a large project could be merged. I mean, something that this Muslim project could be merged with Argentine nationalism is, I think, pretty remarkable.
What? There's a, and I meant to look this up because I can't remember his name, but those who are familiar with Peronist studies, there's a, there's an Argentine philosopher who likes to refer to Peronism as an empty signifier.
Yeah.
Meaning that it can mean, you know, anything that an adherent to Peron might believe it to mean. That's why you have the extreme left and the extreme right in the same political movement.
Sure. And Menem, even people like Menem, he is originally from, his family was from the Middle East originally, right?
Absolutely. And so, I mean, what we see is a lot of, especially the Syrians and Lebanese, families in the interior really come to achieve the highest rungs of political power in the interior through the Peronist movement.
Right.
Menem perhaps being the most famous, but certainly not exclusive to his family. And so you think of the Saadi family in Catamarca, you think of the Sapag family in the province of Neuquén, which is kind of south of Mendoza, so it's up in, and it's up in the mountain, the Andes Mountains. So yeah, this was a vehicle that many Syrian and Lebanese immigrants, including Muslims, utilized to achieve some political power.
Now, I know you focus on Argentina, but just thinking about Muslim immigration around Latin America, because I know there's very large Palestinian origin population in Chile and other countries. Do you know, was the timing of this migration similar to Argentina, or is Argentina unique?
No, they're all part of the same wave. And it is interesting where certain communities end up. So you have the Palestinians in Chile. Many of them are from Bethlehem and the surrounding villages.
Okay.
But you do have a couple, if you will, Muslim villages that are represented among that group. You have large number of Alawite Muslims from Syria that are in Rio. A guy by the name of Paulo Pinto, a Brazilian ethnographer, has done some really interesting work on them. But this is all in the same time frame, if you will, post-1890 to 1914. That's like the period of most intense migration from the Eastern Mediterranean to Latin America, and they go in a variety of places. You have a large Palestinian population as well in Central America, a large Syrian population in Venezuela too, and Lebanese as well in Colombia. So you think of the guy who lost to Gaitan for the nomination to become president in the 1950s in Colombia. He was a son of a Lebanese immigrant, Turbay, and his grandnephew would become president in the end of the 1970s, Julio Cesar Turbay Ayala. So they're all over the map.
So was there any kind of stereotype like they are good shopkeepers or they are good? I mean, what was especially because it's non-populous countries are also inviting this immigration. What do you think for them was the attraction?
I think it was the opportunity to actually make cash. There's a phenomenon across the Americas, not just Latin America, but in Central America and North America as well, of the itinerant peddler.
Yeah.
Excuse me. If you're familiar with the musical Oklahoma, you have the Turkish peddler.
Okay.
Right? So it's even made it into American popular culture. And it's in Argentine popular culture as well. They're called mercachifles. It was, you know, they were represented. Now, they were many of them. There was popular prejudicial discourses against this sort of, if you will, not panhandling, but hawking of goods, because the idea was, well, they're not producing anything. They're just middlemen. Right. They're just skimming, which is a discourse in Argentina now that's used against the Chinese.
OK,
but that's a discussion, you know, perhaps a little bit later when we talk about more contemporary immigration flows. So there were really two main ways that they could make cash is they could be itinerant peddlers or small shopkeepers or work in factories. And so you see both paths. But for reasons not fully well understood, you did have some farmers, but not nearly as many as, say, when you think of other population flows.
Okay. And this is also a question that's not directly related to your research, but sort of connected. And that is, what kind of connection did they retain the countries of origin? Did they have a foreign policy impact? Did that change the way that South American countries viewed the Middle East?
Yes. Well, it's very interesting. Perón attempts to curry favor with Middle Eastern countries in the early years of the foundation of the United Nations.
Okay.
And Perón's Third Way, in many ways, was a forerunner to the non-alignment movement. And last summer, I was doing research in the French diplomatic archives, and they actually comment on this. The French are bemused. They said, why it's unclear to us why Perón would reach out and have these sort of really strong relationships with Middle Eastern countries, because these countries were predominantly Muslim and based on the conservative nature of the Argentine Catholic Church.
Uh-huh.
But for me, it's clearly linked to his third wave or third way, excuse me, position about being non-aligned with either the Soviets or the Americans.
Okay, because some of it I would also think would be a kind of a knee-jerk hostility to Israel. And maybe that's wrong, but I feel like now, it's because I know the Chilean case, is that a lot of countries are hesitant to they don't want to side with Israel, in part because Israel's so close to the U.S., but because they have these large Middle Eastern populations and Palestinian populations that are really opposed to any kind of pro-Israel stance.
Well, I think if in that complex, I think it's quite clear that the Syrian Lebanese population were not terribly successful in influencing Perón's government. I mean, he does recognize the state of Israel.
Okay.
And now there's great debate about the Jewish-Argentine relationship to Perón. Ronan Ryan from Tel Aviv University just published a really important book that reclaims, if you will, the Jewish connections to the Peronist movement. There's kind of like, if you will, a collective amnesia about this history and this relationship that had been curried. And what Ranan argues is that it's Peron that validates and legitimates a multicultural Argentina, right? That these what he calls a mosaic of ethnicities was validated under Peron.
Okay, Jewish and Muslim.
Jewish, Muslim. I mean, at this moment, binational identities, if you will, or hyphenated
okay.
identities,
yeah.
were perfectly welcome and not. They weren't contradictory.
Right.
Now, earlier in the 20th century, certainly you had these different immigrant populations that were actively involved in homeland politics. You think of the Catalonians under Primo de Rivera. You think of the Syrian and Lebanese nationalists during the late Ottoman period, right? So it is a hotbed. The Irish as well, in the late teens and early 1920s. These are spaces of diasporic nationalism and activism.
Okay, so one last question as we're thinking too about more contemporary Argentina or Latin America, and that is, did you have these flows that came after 1890 and into the 20th century? Did they continue, sort of chain migration where family members came? Has that been a continuous process, or did it drop off?
It has continued, but it has dropped off at the same time. The level of intensity, like the quantity, certainly is nothing like it was a century ago. But at the same time, they have created some spaces and have accepted some refugees from the Syrian civil war.
Okay.
But again, these are flows that are these are trickles as opposed to the massive flows of the late 19th and early 20th century.
Okay, well, with that, we are out of time. I've been talking to Stephen Hyland, who's assistant professor in the Department of History and Political Science at Wingate University. And check out, look for his book on Arab-speaking immigrants in Argentina. Is that out yet, or is that just coming out?
It'll be out in November.
November. Perfect for Christmas.
Perfect.
Or
stocking
Hanukkah
stuffer.
Or anything. Yes, stocking stuffer. All right, Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Greg.